when I would go through these episodes, I basically was, I was in the house and I'd be almost bedridden for 1, 2, sometimes 3 weeks at a time. I just didn't want to be around anymore. And I remember when I would have those conversations with the doctor when Mary was present, it was like, man, even though I was in like a really dark spot, I noticed that it helped when I was talking to these people about what I was going through. And I was kind of like this light bulb in my head. It was like, I mean, I can be more open about this. Maybe that'll help me and in turn help other people. It makes me feel more comfortable. It kind of gets rid of that black sheep label.
It's showtime, everybody! Showtime!
You've been living in a dream world, Neo.
Yeah.
This is the world as it exists today.
Life moves pretty fast. You don't stop and look around once in a while, you could miss it.
Listen, we talking about practice.
Hey, Pete, on the dude's rug.
Donnie, you're out of your element.
I see. You think this has nothing to do with you.
Don't ever trash talk Black Jesus.
This is the Adventure Stash with Payson McKelvin.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the show. Really excited to bring you today's conversation with Taylor Ledeen, someone that I've been racing with for quite a while, but also someone that I haven't gotten to know very well until this conversation. It wasn't until I saw his YouTube film that came out very recently that pulled back the curtain on his lifelong battle with depression and anxiety that I thought, you know, I got to catch up with this guy. He's always been a solid racer, always struck me as a nice guy, but it was just yet another example of you just never know what other people are going through. And there are so many incredible stories out there that go beyond the race course. And so I'm really glad that he was able to jump on and join us and give us even, you know, deeper background and more perspective on this challenge that he's had and how he's navigated it. And I'm sure it will resonate with many of y'all. With the exception of tech talk type stuff like bike setup, by far the most number of questions we get, direct messages I get, all that sort of thing, are about mental health. Requests for conversations around mental health, ideas about different topics regarding mental health. It's clearly something that is finally becoming less taboo. And so I'm really grateful for people like Taylor who are willing to really be honest and vulnerable in that conversation. If I sound tired today, it is because I am. I just wrapped up a 28-hour training week, 8+ hours yesterday with an awesome crew exploring some new to us gravel roads and single track. And it was just an awesome, memorable adventure day. I love this time of year as we ramp up for Unbound because you just get to go on kind of big soul rides. Granted, I had some very spicy threshold intervals around hour 6.5, which is, as I say that, sounds ridiculous, but that's kind of what Unbound requires of us these days. And I'm very thankful to be feeling better again. For those that follow me on social, you'll know that April was a bit of a tough month for me, but I'm feeling solid. Training is going well, and it was just an awesome day yesterday. I used the Osprey Duro 1.5 hydration pack, and I want to say thank you to Osprey for supporting today's show and just making stellar products for adventuring, racing, travel, whatever it is. One of the big, awesome improvements they've made in 2023 is that all of their bike hydration packs are getting updated to be 100% recycled and Blue Sign approved main body materials. And this is something Osprey has prioritized forever, just being a good company. Along with making excellent products, they've always been supporters of local organizations, like Durango Devo here in our area, and also much, you know, broader things like environmentally friendly choices. So I want to say a big thank you to Osprey for supporting today's episode. If you want to go check out Osprey's awesome line of products, I highly recommend you go to osprey.com. Thank you all so much for listening, and we'll catch you after the show. What prompted that move to Bentonville? Because I know you guys seemed really... I mean, obviously, I don't know you very well, but it from afar, it seemed like y'all were really settled in to Arizona there and, you know, had a long, I think, pretty long-term relationship with Pivot at the time. What prompted the move?
So yeah, Mary and I have lived in Phoenix pretty much our whole lives. I mean, my family moved to Phoenix when I was 2, hers around the same time. We lived, before we moved to Arkansas, we only lived probably 2.5 miles from the high school that we both went to and that we actually met at. Mm-hmm. And Phoenix is where all of our friends and family are. But it was just came to a point where we were looking to buy our first home.
Yeah.
And Phoenix was just getting crazy. And it was just like, you know, I don't want to be house poor on our first home. And so we, of course, looked at options in Colorado, Utah. Would love to gone to one of those two states, but again, just really expensive in 2021. And so obviously we had heard everything about Northwest Arkansas, never even been to the state. And within 2 days, my wife was on a flight out here. I think she toured 12 houses in like 36 hours. And we committed to a home I was still in Phoenix and we committed to a home here. It was a place to go that was a lot more affordable. And that we have heard great things about. And it seems like, yeah, the opportunity here is more than what we had in Phoenix for what we do. And yeah, we couldn't be happier. We're in Bella Vista, just north of Bentonville. But yeah, it's been an incredible move for us. Like we're super, super happy with it.
Yeah. Yeah. Phoenix is, it's interesting. I feel like, so I'm a huge mainstream sports fan. And I'm always listening to basketball podcasts and stuff. And some of the big conversation topics are when teams will be, you know, bought and sold. Like the Phoenix Suns, for example, just were acquired for a massive number, you know, setting new records. And a lot of the conversation was about how the three, if you're someone that's looking to buy a sports team, like the three most desirable places are LA, New York City, and sometimes forgotten, but just as desirable as Phoenix. And I remember thinking like, really? You know, that's not because it's not an amazing place, but to be put on the level of like the rich and famous, comparable to New York City and LA. But the more I heard about that whole process, the more I realized that Phoenix has quickly become kind of like that third place. And it doesn't surprise me that the housing market followed suit, because you on paper it seems like moving to a very outdoor centered, incredible playground centered small town like Bentonville would be more expensive, but it's pretty cool that that opportunity was there for you guys.
For sure. And like, yeah, Bentonville proper is pretty expensive, so that's why we're in Bella Vista. The area really well. There's not much commercial traffic north of Bentonville. There's a little bit in Bella Vista, but Bella Vista proper is definitely a lot more affordable than Bentonville. So yeah, it's a big change for a big metropolitan city like Phoenix for sure. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like I said, we couldn't be happier. But I just saw the Suns tied up series last night.
They did. Yeah. Do you follow sports at all?
Yeah, I'm a big hockey fan. Nice. So hockey playoffs start obviously around the same time as basketball. Yep. So I'm watching a ton of hockey right now. And then big football fan too. But being from Phoenix, like Phoenix is a pretty big basketball town.
It is. Yeah.
So the Suns are a big deal there. Yeah.
What's it been like? I'll just mention that I reached out to you and wanted to have you on the podcast today because I finally watched your film, which is at times pretty heavy, but definitely prompted me to want to chat with you. And it's interesting too, because we had a lot of people reach out and mention your film and or you and say, you need to get Taylor on over the last handful of months. And so it's been on my list, and that's a lot of what I want to talk about today, and I'm sure we will talk about today. But before we roll up our sleeves and really dive into that stuff, I am curious what it's been like to transition to Bentonville, because it's a very unique town, obviously famous at this point, and there's a lot of pride there locally in terms of what's been built and what you have. Just very tight-knit community, almost like I would compare it in some ways to Durango, who obviously has this racing heritage and small town with high concentration of bike riding enthusiasm, but what was it like to go from probably I'm sure you had an amazing community in Phoenix too, but it was probably somewhat disparate. And Bentonville, you know, it's kind of cranked to 11 at all times. You know, whenever I drop by, I have to remind myself that whenever I drop by the Meteor, it's basically like you're at a race expo and you just need to expect to have 10 conversations. Yeah. What's that been like?
It's been really good. Honestly, like I think in the last year or two of living in Phoenix, I was really trying to figure out, and this kind of touches base quickly on like the film, and I appreciate you watching that. Touches base kind of on that, but like I had noticed living in Phoenix, that atmosphere for me created a lot of tension and a lot of anxiety. It just felt like it was go, 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 go all the time. And for better or for worse, and I feel guilty for saying this at sometimes, like I need to slow my life down. And I learned that kind of in the later stages of living in Phoenix is like, okay, you need to make these calls. And my wife, Mary, was on board of like realizing that slowing down was a good thing rather than just constantly going. And that's what I noticed in moving to Northwest Arkansas was a change of pace in a good way. So it did allow us to slow down. While there are times where it can feel like full throttle at all times, especially things revolving around bikes, all in all, it has been a change of pace where I feel like I can catch my breath. Mm-hmm. And it's not to sound like overly dramatic about it, but it is the truth. It's up in Bella Vista here. It's just Mary, my wife, and I, who I've been with since high school. I'm sure people have met her at bike races, and our two dogs. Yeah. And it just feels like it's simplified life up here. And I really enjoy that. And what's really cool about Northwest Arkansas too, is people have heard of Bentonville, right? They think of the trails in Bentonville and Bella Vista, but there's so much more in this area. There's the monument trails that a lot of people don't know about. There's the Imba Epic trails around Northwest Arkansas that are incredible. And then there's the Boston Mountain Range just south of Fayetteville, which in my opinion is world-class gravel roads. Big elevation out there. You can find 30 to 45 minute climbs all day long in that area. I'm sure you've probably heard of that Gravel Doom event.
Yeah. Yeah. So it looks so gnarly.
Yeah. It kind of like it utilizes a lot of the Boston Mountain Range. Okay. And nothing is flat down there. And that's only a short drive from Bentonville. You can be in that range within 30 minutes, a quick car ride. So it's pretty unlimited up here for sure.
The quality of life obviously is pretty hard to beat if you're a bike rider. How far is it to your closest single track, like doorstep to trail?
Back 40 is probably third of a mile from the house.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Sounds like I can, right. Yeah, I can enter, yeah. I can be on the back 40 on single track within just 2 or 3 minutes.
Yeah. That's awesome. So I don't usually do it this way, but I want to walk through your early life just briefly, because there's two themes in this film. And for those that don't know, you put a film up on YouTube, or I should say it looks like the producer or was it the editor, Dylan Harris? Who's Dylan Harris?
Dylan Harris is the one who made the film. Yeah. He's a good friend of ours from Phoenix. He does a lot of his backgrounds in kind of ultra running. So he's done a lot of ultra running films as well.
Cool. So on Dylan Harris's YouTube channel, y'all published a film called Shifting Mindset. And this came out when did this come out?
We did the preview at Big Sugar back in October of 22.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yep. Cool. So it's an 18 minute film, and there are, I'm sure you know this too, there are many films involving endurance athletes that glorify suffering and make the athletes look really badass and are hypey, and that's about it. Like there's not a whole lot of depth beyond that. And those films are cool and sometimes they do well, but for me at this point, they leave something to be desired because they're a dime a dozen. I mean, they're no film is easy to make, but as far as films go, those are easier to make. Hard films are the ones that, you know, go a few layers deeper and have parallel storylines of some sort. And yours, I knew would, but I didn't necessarily understand to the extent that it would be, you know, vulnerable and honest and hard hitting. And so I was really impressed. And I actually watched it a couple times. And it's really, like I said earlier, it's really what prompted me to want to have you on ASAP. But before we dig into all that, I'm curious about what's the most general blanket term you like to call the anxiety that you deal with, some of the health issues that are talked about in this film?
I would say anxiety, which then, I mean, anxiety and depression definitely coincide. And that's something that this film kind of talks about is, for me personally, anxiety doesn't exist without the depression, and the depression doesn't exist without the anxiety. And I've found in my life, those two, once one ramps up, the other closely follows.
Right. So, sorry, that was sort of convoluted the way I was getting at that, but sort of what I'm trying to get at is like, that's been an underlying thing, presumably your whole life in one form or another, something to an extent you've probably been born with. But at some point, bike riding kind of entered your life too. And I'm really curious about when those things started to exist together, because it's a really interesting relationship, I think. And so I want to quickly kind of retrace your earlier days. In the film, you talk some about high school. That's where you and Mary met, as you referenced earlier. If you want to give us a little bit of a picture, if you can recall at what point in your life you started to notice these feelings or thoughts or that sort of thing, part A, and part B, when did you start to think, well, maybe this is a little bit out of the ordinary or beyond what other people or most people grapple with?
For sure. Yeah. I mean, I knew from a really early age, I was so young that I didn't know it was quote unquote depression or anxiety. I just knew that something was off. Well before the age of even 10.
Oh, wow.
I just felt, it's hard to say that I felt emotion more than other people, right? Because you never know how somebody else is feeling without truly having conversations with those people, and you should never discount what people are going through. But I just, at that age, I specifically remember a trip that my family and I went to California, and we went to SeaWorld, and I can almost laugh at it now. But I remember returning home from that trip. I was probably, six, 7 or 8 years old. And when I'm sure you've heard of the term post-vacation blues, right? Everybody gets that in some way, especially after bike races. But man, I felt that really, I had that sensation weigh heavily on me at a really young age. And it was super, super heavy, almost to the point of like, I couldn't, sorry, my dog's drinking. I couldn't get over coming home from a trip like that. And it went from post-vacation blues into other emotions that I felt really, really heavily. So I would say before the age of 10, I knew something was off, or I was different in some ways. And then fast forward up until high school when I started riding bikes and I met Mary. And obviously at that age, I was more mature to understand what was going on. And in high school, on many different occasions, I went and saw doctors and therapists. And I was super rebellious at that age, where a doctor would prescribe me medication and I would buy into it for a month or two or even longer. And then all of a sudden I would get in my own head, freak out and stop medication cold turkey. And I would just spiral out of control. And I that didn't do me any favors, obviously. During this period of being on and off medication, I was riding bikes, and I was fortunate enough to grow up in a family where my dad was able to provide me with the opportunity to travel. and he would go with me and we'd travel the bike races. And all along, like while I was super thankful to have the opportunity to go to bike races with him and travel to different states, at this time I was racing downhill. I kind of felt guilty in a way that I had this opportunity. So I felt like I had to repay him with results, right? Like if he was taking time away from work, if he was spending this money to get him and I to X location, I felt like, okay, well, I need to get a result on paper in these downhill races to then prove to him that it's worth him taking time off work and for him to pay money out of his pocket for travel expenses and lot. I mean, you know, it's stuff is not cheap, right?
Yeah.
That's a heavy. So you would have been in high school at this point, a teenager?
Yeah. Yep. And this.
Ooh, that's a heavy thing to carry, man.
This was all, for the most part, I would say 95% of that I made up in my head. Right. Yeah. If I would have just had the courage to have those conversations with my dad. At the time, I was pretty intimidated by my dad. Around this time, my parents divorced, and it was just, yeah, it was. I would just say in simple forms, I was intimidated by my dad. My dad is someone who I really look up to, and I obviously love to death. And our relationship at times felt pretty rocky. So I think it was me just not knowing how to navigate those waters. And our relationship now is drastically different. It's majorly, it's improved night and day from those times. But I made up those scenarios in my head. And I think looking back at them, it kind of eats me up where I didn't have those conversations with him directly, because I would have known, right, that they were fabricated in my own head.
Yeah.
I pair that with everything that was going on in my head with the anxiety and depression. And it was just this kind of this recipe for disaster. And,
I was about to say, that's what I was getting at is early on was this, pursuit of racing. Was it helpful? Or did it kind of add to the weight? And you're pretty clearly describing added weight.
Yeah. I thought it was helpful at the time. Right. But no, I was doing it for the wrong reasons. 100% the wrong reasons. I still enjoyed the bike. Like I enjoyed going for rides. Back then I wasn't quote unquote training or anything. I would just go ride my bike after school. But yeah, I mean, I look back now and kind of kick myself of like, man, I just wish I would have had those conversations earlier. But at the same time, if you don't know, you don't know. You just simply don't know. Luckily around that time too, Mary and I had started our relationship, and she was kind of the only one who I let in and told what was going on in my head and some pretty dark, dark things that were happening around that time. So she's been here from kind of the start of at times being the only person to know what's really been going on.
Yeah. Did she take it seriously at first? Because I think a lot of people can relate to, if you're on top of a tall building and you look over the edge, there's some curiosity there. Like, what if I jumped? What would that feel like? What would actually happen? I think that's a pretty common thought that just kind of floats into many people's minds and then typically moves on. My understanding is for you, those thoughts don't necessarily pass on as quickly. But for someone that's not in your head, like that line, if you're just telling someone about how you're feeling, that line could be pretty fine. Like, oh, lots of people think that. At what point did she take it seriously at first?
I definitely feel that she took it seriously from the get-go, just because I felt comforted when I was around her, especially from the earlier times. I was not afraid to let her in on what was going on, mainly because of the way that she handled it. And I know that she took it seriously. It'd be different to let someone in on something like that, right? If you told them and you were kind of hesitant on how they reacted and you're like, man, maybe this person doesn't take me seriously. That would have affected me negatively, but no, I trusted her from the get-go. And in all honesty, like the heaviest times were around 20, 2020 and then 2021, shortly before, a couple months before Unbound in 2021, when I won the XL, those were the heaviest times. And she, we had built up, obviously we'd been together, we've been together since high school, but we built up this kind of trust, this foundation of trust where, yeah, even when it got to be its darkest time, I was like, okay, I know I can trust her. I know I can rely on her. And yeah, she is, she's never flinched in that. Mm.
So before we move on to kind of present day, and I do want to go over that period that you just mentioned, 2020 and 2021. In a way, I'm surprised that you ended up being a professional cyclist in light of what you've described your teenage years like. In all honesty, because, I mean, making it is really hard, right? Like, very, very few of us make it. And I think a lot of it has to do with the general challenges that almost all teenagers go through. You know, there's all of the social stuff that's in flux. You're figuring yourself out. You're figuring out what you like, what motivates you. It's just a time of massive uncertainty and massive change. And the way that you're describing bike racing at the time doesn't sound like it was necessarily a hugely healthy thing for you.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't maybe the North Star or the compass that it can be for young riders oftentimes. So how did you, when it was time to move away from home and you didn't have that structure anymore, and it sounds like very, very beneficial that you had Mary starting early on, and yet there was still probably this very big transition where you didn't have that home structure anymore and you weren't going to high school and all that sort of thing. What did that bridge look like to where you are today? Like, how did you navigate, and how did it end up being that you do this full time at this point? Because it feels unlikely, if you know, not to sound callous, but no, is that fair to say, do you think?
Totally. Like, it's funny. I'm someone who, like, I feel like my memory is really good, right? So I look back at those times, and I'd be lying if I said I didn't try to forget a lot of those times, to be completely honest. Like, it even comes back to, if I hear certain music that was relevant around that time, it brings back those memories.
Mm.
Or if I go, if it's even like, this probably sounds crazy to some people, but music or like senses of smell, right? It can bring you back into a spot immediately.
Yeah.
I look back at those times and I'm just like, I just don't want to visit. I don't even like to go back there, just because for me, it just feels like this like jumbled mess where I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what to do. Didn't know where to go. It's not like I didn't have a place, right? Mary and I had an apartment together, but I just didn't know where to go mentally. I didn't know what I was going to do with my life. So it's, those times are kind of difficult to look back on. Especially too, right? Because you said you're at that age where you're developing, you're trying to figure out what to do in life. And I thought I wanted it to be bikes at that time. But it was not a healthy outlet. That's for sure.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was just,
were there conversations about maybe we should try something else? Because when you're in it, it's very hard as an athlete to see the forest for the trees. Like, when it feels like, especially when there's instability elsewhere, it feels like the one thing that you can hang on to sometimes, even when it's not going well in races, you know, you can get out the door and go for a hard training ride. Like, that is a familiar place.
Oh, for sure.
But you had Mary there. Was she ever like, hey, this might not be the best, you might not have the best relationship with this thing, should we try something else? Should we broaden a little here?
She never directly told me that, but I would be willing to bet everything she felt that pretty heavily.
Mm-hmm.
I specifically remember, this was a little bit later past, this was later past high school, obviously, but I remember a time at 24 Hours in the Old Pueblo, I was racing it, and I I oddly enough, I crashed out early in that race. It was a super windy year, crazy windy. And the wind caught me out. I went down really hard right before the sun went down and had to DNF that race. And my dad was at that race with Mary. And I came back just super upset, right? In tears. And I remember making a promise to him. I was like, I'm going to continue to come back to this race until I accomplish the goals and check the boxes that I know I can at this particular event. That event to me is still kind of the most meaningful one. And that was a time where it was kind of like, okay, I think both of them knew that things were rocky. And my dad was going to bike races up until that moment. And, then Mary kind of had to speak up because it wasn't the healthiest relationship to have my dad at bike races. Mm. I was fortunate that Mary kind of spoke up and was like, we're going to go to bike races without you.
Mm. Ooh, that's hard.
Yeah. Yeah. It was super hard. Right. And, I say that with 100% confidence in that my dad's relationship and mine, our relationship has improved so much. Like I had a 45-minute conversation with my dad on the phone last night. Mm-hmm. And I'm super grateful that it has gotten better. But yeah, around those times it was just tough. It was really tough. So I think around that time Mary knew, like, or didn't know, but I think she was wanting to ask, do we do something else here? Because it's not really working out.
Yeah. 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 So you just mentioned 24 hours in the Old Pueblo, and I think it's worth, you know, we should give you credit for being someone that's been doing some of this ultra stuff longer than most of us that have in recent years kind of dabbled in it. I think for many of us, the pandemic was sort of this on-ramp to trying different things and pushing longer rides just because we had the opportunity to with racing on hold, obviously. Mm-hmm. But you're someone that's done it for a pretty good while. Did you gravitate towards that because it's a little bit more of a, usually like a cerebral, you know, emotional journey? Or how did that interest come about in this longer distance stuff? Because for those that aren't familiar with your career, like you're in the Grand Prix, you do, basically we do the same races, you and I predominantly, but you started doing some of this 24-hour stuff and this more ultra distance stuff quite a bit earlier. How did that interest come about?
My dad had always raced 24 hours of Moab on a team when I was growing up, even before I started riding bikes. And it always was kind of mind blowing to think that people would ride their bikes for a whole day. Right. Even if you're doing it on a team. And I remember one particular time asking him like, hey, what would you think if I tried that? And he was like, yeah, you should ask some people if you can get a team together, like at the time, a junior team. And growing up in Phoenix, I was the only person to ride bikes. None of my best friends to this day, they don't ride bikes. And I'm 100% okay with that. But I couldn't find anybody that would be a teammate, and nor did I really want to rely on other people to have, right, to rely on throughout the night. And so I sat on that idea for a couple of years, and then I just had the idea. I was like, well, I'll just, instead of relying on other people, why don't I just try it by myself? And my dad was kind of all on board with going and seeing how it went. And the first time was a disaster.
Like a total, how old were you?
The first time I ever tried a 24, I think I was 18.
So this was solo?
Solo, yeah. It was a disaster.
That's crazy.
That's so young. Well, back then, right, it was like, it's a lot more common now to see someone in their late teens try like a 24 and ultra. But back then, I remember the race organizer actually called my dad and was like, hey, we noticed your son's age on this. Does he know what he's getting into? My dad was like, yeah, I think he knows what he's getting into. We had some conversations. But that style of racing, I think it attracted me because I could kind of get lost in my own head during the race. While I thought it would be helpful, in turn, I don't think it was helpful at all.
Yeah.
You know, right. It doesn't even have to be an ultra. I mean, I don't even think a 24, I wouldn't even consider a 24 as like quote unquote ultra. There's events out there that you can really go into your head. Like you can think about CTR, you can think about AZT, Tour Divide. So it was kind of maybe just like trying to dabble in that world. And then I felt like, okay, if I didn't like it, I could pull back and then dabble in these 24s and then pull back. And then, I really didn't commit to them until much, much later, until I would say like around the 2017, 2018 mark is when I really committed to them.
Yeah. Okay. So this film is a very classic example of you don't necessarily know what someone else is dealing with. And my perception of you before becoming familiar with all this stuff is that you are a really nice, relatively soft-spoken guy who is always a solid racer, but I didn't really know too much about you. Certainly didn't know your personality very much. But you are always just really consistent, and you know, we're basically at many of the same races. But there are a lot of people in the field that we race, and a lot of impressive racers, and some are, you know, very outspoken and share a lot, and others you know very little about. And so you can't know everyone's personality, obviously, and you were one of the people whose personality I didn't know as well, but just sort of peripherally, like you always felt to me like someone who, just as an example, you know, if we end up in a group of eight together and we're trying to chase down a group in front and someone isn't pulling through, you're not going to be the guy that's first to yell at them and be like, pull through. You always just seem like a nice guy, a nicer guy. But again, I didn't know you very well. But if there's one thing I've learned over the years, it's that you just never know what other people are going through. And I actually remember this with Keegan a couple of years ago. He had a, not to go into too much detail, but he had a family member that was going through a really challenging health thing. And he chose not to talk about it at all. And I kind of heard about it through the grapevine, and he and I had some conversations about it. But it was this classic example of, here's this guy who's dominating like he always does, incredible athlete, but he's got this thing back home that's really tough. And no one else really knows about it. And they're, as everyone does, holding him up on this pedestal, you know, celebrating the winner, but there's this other stuff going on. And you're just a classic example of that too, where, you know, I saw you as this really, I see you as this really solid racer, this nice guy, but you have this other thing going on in your life that's really big, and made the decision recently to talk about it, to share it, and to let people in a really, really honest way. And I'm curious why you decided to do that and why now, you know, why this past fall. Is it something that you'd considered for a while, or was there some sort of moment that kind of gave you the confidence to finally do it? How did all that come about?
It was a lot of years of hiding it from people. Mary obviously is known since we've been together. I would say the only other person that really knew, especially from a very young age, was my mom. She knew that I was dealing with anxiety and depression because at a young age, as a minor, she would go to the doctor's appointments with me. I always felt kind of like a black sheep, especially in high school. And in that way, I never wanted to talk about it. My best friend, who's name is Taylor as well, he knew a little bit about it in high school. I didn't open up the way that I should have. But I think, I mean, my dad is someone who, like I said earlier, I was intimidated by when I was younger, but I also looked up to, and I continue to look up to, but he's someone who when I was younger, really struggled with like kind of sharing his emotions. And when I met Mary, she noticed with me right away. Like, She said if I was upset, I wouldn't show emotion. If I was down in the dumps, I wouldn't let people in. And I know that that caused her frustration from the get-go when we started dating. And then you fast forward through high school, through teens and 20s. There came times where I would have conversations with her. Was like when the depression anxiety was so bad, it almost made me physically ill to the point of when I would go through these episodes, I was in the house and I'd be almost bedridden for 1, 2, sometimes 3 weeks at a time. I like driving a vehicle felt way too overwhelming. Even like making food for myself felt overwhelming. And so it felt like the only release from that was like I touched it in the film is like, I just didn't want to be around anymore. Like it wasn't like a scary thought to me. It was just like, okay, how do I get relief from this? And that's where these like really, really heavy conversations started with Mary and then also started with therapists. And the thing I kept going back to was like, I convinced myself that I was this black sheep and that these certain feelings that I was having only were mine. And so I was like, I remember asking with the doctor one time, like in tears, like, please tell me that this will go away. And I remember when I would have those conversations with the doctor, when Mary was present, it was like, man, even though I was in like a really dark spot, I noticed that it helped when I was talking to these people about what I was going through. And I was kind of like this light bulb in my head. It was like, okay, this is like a beneficial thing of talking to other people about it. Granted, they were doctors and Mary was present, but I was like, why don't I mean, I can be more open about this. Maybe that'll help me and in turn help other people. And sure enough, it did. Like I haven't really gone into super depth with strangers or other people, maybe on social media, but it does help me for sure. It makes me feel more comfortable. It kind of gets rid of that, black sheep label. Right. And I hope it helps other people too. Like you said, you just never know what somebody's going through. I can use an example, like, and this is a bike racing example, but a kid that I knew and still know growing up, it didn't matter. I use him as an example. His name's Nick Thomas. It didn't matter if he would get first place or last place in a bike race. When you would talk to him after a race, he was so stoked. Even if he finished at the end of the, like back of the pack. And Mary and I, after so many races, had conversations with each other. It was like, man, that's really inspiring to see and super cool because he does, like his self-worth isn't on a result. And it was just interesting to see, like, you don't know what somebody's going through, but for him, he wore his heart on his sleeve and he was always stoked. Right. And I think it was 100% genuine. I guarantee it's 100% genuine. So for him, it was like, that was really cool. But then the guy or girl next to him, you just never know. Like they can act really stoked, but are they honest about that? Is there something deeper and darker going on behind the scenes? You just never know. So that's kind of a long winded answer of answering your question of why I decided to start talking about it is, the main reason selfishly was to help myself. And then secondary, I think that other people, or I hope that other people are benefiting from it as well.
Yeah. Does it feel like there's been a shift in how you carry this post film? Like, does it feel now that it's out there, was there any sort of like group therapy session effect? We're just putting it all out there, kind of took some weight off. Did the hiding it, so to speak, add some weight, I guess is my point. And now there's been a little bit of lifting of that or not so much.
Yeah, I would say there's been lifting for sure, especially not even just in the, more so in like in my personal life. Like we go back to Phoenix and with friends and family, right? It's not this dark secret. It's not this thing that I keep locked away. Like, it kind of feels awkward at times, yeah, knowing that people know certain things about me that maybe I did hide. But
yeah,
like, I'm done keeping that a secret. And that's just the way that I approach, yeah, it, right? I totally understand if other people aren't comfortable sharing, and I respect that 100%. But just for me, it did help.
Yeah. So when you're in the throes of an episode like this, what gets you through? And I know that during like really severe episodes, it can feel tenuous, like you're barely getting through moment to moment, mm-hmm, based on what you described in the film. But how does it, if you can kind of describe what it's like to feel yourself slip into a phase like that, and then how you just pass the days, because what you describe in the film is, it just sounds so consuming. And I don't know how much I want to get into this, just because it's a weird, like, one-off thing, but I actually had 2 days of what you're describing, and it was possibly the 2 scariest days of my life, but it was only 2 days.
But still, 2 days, like, you can't discount that.
No. But I mean, and I'm kind of curious, like, if you're willing to kind of describe in detail, like, day to day, what the process is for getting through that. Cause you describe things like just basically being bedridden, you know, the curtains drawn, all that sort of thing. And for weeks. That's a long time.
Yeah. The only relief that I would get during those episodes was if I was asleep. That's all I wanted to do, because for me, it was like, when I was asleep, then I wouldn't feel these feelings. And I would get so confused when I'm in those episodes. Like, the brain fog is just next level. And so I think that's why sleeping for me was like, okay, now if I'm asleep, then I don't have to deal with these side effects. And the more episodes I would go through, and the more I would just realize, like, okay, if I'm asleep, then I don't feel these things. I think that is kind of where these suicidal thoughts came in, was realizing that, okay, like, the sleep can make these symptoms disappear. So yeah, you put 2 and 2 together. That's where those thoughts crept in.
Yeah.
Then the last really major episode is when Nico's drinking again. The last major, major episode is when we discovered and sought out ketamine therapy. I touch on it,
yeah,
briefly in the film. And that, mm-hmm, for me was a total life-changing experience. I'm convinced it saved my life, especially with how horrible that last episode was. That just, it changed things around pretty rapidly for me. I wish that we had found out earlier. I wish we had kind of looked into those options sooner, but we didn't. And yeah, it was life-changing for sure, in a positive way.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was just, going back to those times and in those episodes, the only relief I would get was sleep. And that's when I knew, it was like, oh man, this is not good to feel relief if you're really not present. Right. And focusing on that didn't lead me down any healthy roads.
Yeah. Does it feel like, and we can move on after this, but does it feel like you almost have someone else's brain for that period of time? Like, you've entered someone else's, like, someone else has taken over your body type thing? Is that too, too ethereal?
No, like, it was just, after a couple of days, it almost felt like I would almost put this end date on, because if I would have an episode and then I'd get out of the episode and I'd have another episode, all I could relate it to was the previous episode, right? So if the previous episode lasted 2 weeks and the current episode I was in was on day 3, I'd sit there and, like, it was almost this, like, ticking clock, mm-hmm, of like, okay, once you hit that 2 week period, you'll be good. And it never went that way. It never was like, obviously, 2 weeks on the dot, boom, you're cleared up, you're good to go, like, go outside, everything's, it was never like that. Sometimes it would last 3 weeks, sometimes it would be a week and a half. And I hated myself for getting in that mindset of like, okay, it's day 2, tick, 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 Day three, check it off, go to the next day. But I couldn't help it. Like, I was so consumed with this anxiety and depression, and the brain fog was just so intense that I was always in those moments. And I remember I'd be like, okay, I was like, there's 6 days left until the 2 week mark. And Mary's like, you can't think like that. You cannot think like that, because if it lasts 3 weeks, what are you going to, you can't just fall back deeper after the 2 week mark when it lasts another week. So it was so foggy and just confusing. And yeah, I think definitely too, just being in bed for weeks on end didn't do me any favors, but it would have been too much to ask to do anything else really.
Yeah. Have you talked to other people that have experienced things similar to this, like compared notes?
I've heard brain fog is a really common side effect.
Mm-hmm.
And that was always the first symptom. And I would typically, like 3 days before I was deep into an episode, I knew it was coming on. I would wake up in the morning and I would tell Mary, I said, I'm falling into one of these episodes. I know it's right around the corner. And she'd be like, how do you, like, first of all, why are you being so negative? Second of all, how do you know this is happening? I was like, I can feel the brain fog coming on. And the first symptom that I would have, and this probably sounds so crazy to people, is the first symptom of brain fog for me would be, and it even sounds weird to say this, but it would be trying to predict things. And what I think that was, is I think it was almost like the chemicals in my brain weren't lined up. So my brain was trying to think one step ahead of what was actually happening.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. If you can imagine that, then it just throws your brain for a loop. And so you're always trying to play catch up. And I know it sounds just so wild, but that's the truth. Like that's how I knew it would start. And that was one of the main things was that brain fog.
Man, that is crazy what you just described. So my experience echoes exactly what you just described. And
really?
Yeah. It was probably two and a half days of thinking that my brain had broken and it being so powerful and so strong that it felt like someone else had entered my body. And that's why I brought that up earlier, because kind of what you're describing is I felt just for a couple of days for a different reason.
Yep.
But it was the worst 2 days of my life, dude, like by far. And so when I saw this film and you threw out almost nonchalantly, it can last 2 or 3 weeks, I just sat back in my chair and I was just like, oh my God, like, how is this guy here? Like, it hit me so hard.
But it's all relative, right? Like, don't discount your 2 days. I shouldn't discount my 2 weeks. Somebody may be going through it for 2 months, and then somebody may be stuck in it without support for like the foreseeable future. So I think it's all relative, right? I think it doesn't matter if it's for a couple hours, a couple days, weeks, months, whatever it is for you, it's important. And I think that's what we all need to remember, is whatever that person is going through is it's important, and it does mean something and it should be addressed.
Yeah. Yeah. Your process for moving forward, you've talked about this ketamine therapy. Talk about what that's done, what it is. 'Cause for some people, you know, that might send up a little bit of a red flag. Like, ketamine is a scary word, culturally to some people.
For sure.
What is that? What's it done for you? And how do you feel today?
So yeah, ketamine's I would say to most people, it's an unknown thing, right? I think when people hear ketamine, they think of recreational ketamine. This is far from that. When I was in one of my last episodes, we probably were at the doctor's office for, I would say, 7 or 8 hours before they gave me the okay to start ketamine therapy. And ketamine therapy in their medical setting was basically, it's very detailed. So you go in there, they weigh you, and they administer ketamine through an IV based on your exact weight for that day. So it's not like you go into this sketchy doctor and they just shoot you up with ketamine. Like, it's far, far from that. They're there with you. It's in a medical setting. So I had 5 ketamine sessions, all with Mary in the room with me. And those sessions were spread out between, I think it was 3.5 or 4 weeks, 5 sessions. What I really noticed about those was, I wouldn't really say the ketamine therapy helped my anxiety, but for me, it was the depression that it really helped. The anxiety was something I worked through while doing the ketamine therapy. I was going to see a therapist. I think at that time I was seeing her 3 times a week and doing EMDR therapy, which is basically a light bar therapy. It's getting really common in, I think people are using it for traumatic brain injury recovery in some cases, but it's really common in therapy for unlocking your past traumas or getting over anxiety and depression. So I paired those 3 things together on top of getting back on medication for depression. And I would say, since moving to Arkansas, I've probably been in the best place mentally that I've been ever. And so much so that I'm actually weaning off, slowly weaning off my medication for depression. I've really never been confident in weaning off that medication before. It's been cases of freaking out about it and then stopping it cold turkey and going down these really dark paths. So I feel really good about where things are at right now, being able to wean off medication and just being overall, sounds weird, but it's just happy, right? And I think also being aware that I can slip into those episodes at any time, but instead of being terrified of slipping in those episodes, just being aware that it could happen. Whereas in the past, I was always on this like fight or flight response of like, if I woke up in the morning and I had any symptom or sensation that that brain fog was starting, like shit would hit the fan for me. Like life would stop. And I'm in a different place now. And I'm super, super thankful for that.
Yeah. Interesting. So, Is there any recurring fear with this? Because there's something that's not talked about as much, but I think is gradually increasing, is just this the psychological pressure that athletes feel. There was this crazy poll that came out not long ago on NBA players, a survey. And something like 78% of the NBA players characterize themselves as unhappy. You know, these are young guys that make millions and millions of dollars and are performing in front of tens of thousands of people and held up as heroes and icons. And yet 3/4 of them describe themselves as unhappy.
Yeah.
So there's definitely something there. And I think in the last handful of years, thanks to films like yours and just the comfort with which it seems like culturally that this discourse can happen, we're starting to realize that the main challenges of high level athletics are actually some of the ramifications mentally, you know, mental health wise, at this point in your life. Does it feel like this 7-month Grand Prix or chasing 24 hours in the Old Pueblo, are those things that are drivers and giving you purpose and things to look forward to? Or does it still feel like weight, like it did when you were a teenager and it just happens to be your job?
They are motivators so long as I keep things in check, right? Like I'm totally honest with myself. I'm never going to show up and win a race in the Grand Prix series. And I know that, right? I'm okay with that I'm not going to win one of these races. That's the realistic approach. But that's not to say I don't want to be as competitive as I can be. I'm a super competitive person, just like you are, just like everybody racing the Grand Prix, just like everybody who does, I would argue, any amateur bike race in the world. Like, they show up because you're competitive, right? So I don't want people to get that mistaken of, oh, like, I need to remove expectations. And I think some people see that and say, like, oh, it's, then he's okay with not being competitive. That's not the truth at all. I want to show up and do the best that I personally can. I just know, like, I'm not going to win these things, and I'm okay with that. I'm totally okay with that. Because if I tried to win one of these things, A, I'd be very disappointed at all times. So I think just almost removing the expectation of a result on paper for me is a healthy way to approach the season, especially in something that lasts for 7 months, like the Grand Prix. Because we all ultimately don't have control of what the result sheet says. All we have control of is what we can execute on race day. And that's taken a long time for me to figure that out. And it's also taken me a long time to figure that out while having that same approach of, you can have that approach, but you can also remain ultra competitive as well in your own head.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
that's where I'm.
Yeah. I'm curious about, all of that said, you know, you sort of take a big step to the right, in terms of these Grand Prix events for Unbound and do the XL, which is not part of the Grand Prix. The Grand Prix athletes do the 200, the 350 is an event that you've won one time, twice?
Just once. Yeah.
I can't remember. Once. I'm curious what that event feels. Does it feel different than the Grand Prix with everything you just said, where you're not necessarily putting pressure on yourself to win one of the Grand Prix events? But knowing full well that you have won, and there's probably a decent number of people out there following who expect you to do really, really well in the XL. Does that event feel different to you as you prepare, as you think about it, as you fall asleep at night dreaming about winning?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I'd be lying if I said I wasn't aiming to go back to Unbound XL this year to try and win. Like, that's the truth. I'm going there to try and win. But, like, shit happens, right?
Yeah.
You can't control that. The year that I won, I had a, just like everybody that races, doesn't matter what distance you're doing, something is going to go awry out there. And I think the more I can accept that now, I think the more anybody can accept that before going into race day, the better off they're going to be in the long run. So, yeah, I mean, I've also gotten to the point of, if people are expecting me to go back there and quote unquote get a result on paper, win, and I don't, well, that's kind of like, you know, then that's their problem and their disappointment.
Yeah.
It's not my problem that they're disappointed with me. So, I mean, I'm definitely going to go there and do my very best and try and win it. But there's a lot of good people that are racing this year. I think Ted's racing this year. It's going to be a fast field. And I know that. And if I don't win, but I gave it everything I had, so be it. That's where it lands us. And yeah, like, I don't need to tell you that, you know it, you've raced enough bike races, but you can get caught up in that unhealthy mindset. And I'm not discounting anything that Keegan may be going through mentally, right? But Keegan's a monster. Keegan's kind of a level above us all, where he can show up to pretty much any bike race and win it, right?
Yep.
There's one Keegan.
Yeah. I mean, and sometimes I do wonder what it is like to be in his head, because that, I'm sure it's fun to win that consistently and that much.
It's probably not easy though, right? Like, he probably
exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Okay. So at the risk of this podcast going super, super long, it doesn't feel right to not at least touch on this other health issue that you have had in the past. Is it a cardiac issue that causes your blood pressure to drop quickly?
Yeah. It's also, they found an irregular heartbeat after they strapped me up with a Holter monitor after old Pablo that was taking place in the video. And they found that this doesn't happen often, but in most cases, it's triggered by exercise.
Mm. So, damn. That's big. You know, that's a whole other can of worms.
But knock on wood, very few instances since old Pablo. They've only tracked it twice since then.
And is there some sort of medical intervention that you've utilized as part of that? Or is it just sort of like a it could happen type thing, but it's really unusual?
Could happen. It's really unusual. Old Pablo was the third major instance that had happened. The first time passing out, kind of like a quick funny story. The first time it happened, I was riding in Phoenix and I was doing intervals in a neighborhood close to where we lived. It was kind of like a steep hill. And I felt something coming on and there was this guy mowing his lawn and I was like, oh shit, like I'm about to go out here. Like I could feel it coming on. And so I pulled over into his lawn because I thought like, A, if I go down, at least I'll fall in grass. And then B, he'll see me go out. So like he can call somebody.
Oh my God.
So I just like awkwardly pulled into this dude's lawn as he's mowing his lawn. He stops mowing his lawn, kind of like looks at me. I look at him and I'm freaking out internally because my heart rate's just racing at this point. And it was able to settle down. And I just rode away without giving him any context to why I pulled into his lawn. But I got home like super amped up, told Mary I was freaked out. And I look back like that was the first instance that I had felt this before. But I just thought it was kind of funny how how it first came on of pulling in this poor guy. I had no idea why I just awkwardly stopped into his.
Oh my God. So does it feel like when it's coming on, is it that sensation where you stand up too fast and you just get a head rush and get really lightheaded type thing?
No, for me, it feels like if someone, I've never been injected with adrenaline, but that's what it would feel like. Mm. Like your heart rate will go from like, if you're riding at say like 140, it'll go up to like 210 like that. And it feels like there's this flutter in your chest.
Yeah.
And, it's really weird feeling. Like it feels like you're in this fight or flight state instantly with no trigger.
So does your heart rate monitor reflect that? Like, can you see your heart rate go to 210?
Old Pablo, we couldn't see it. We looked back both on a wrist-based heart rate monitor and a chest strap, and we could not see it. I saw it two times previously. So the time in the grass with that guy mowing his lawn, I did see it. And the time after I did see it. And then they picked it up in the Holter monitor as well.
So it's happened three times and this is just like a risk assessment thing where it, you know, you go on however many bike rides a year and there's a, you know, 0.03 chance of it happening or whatever. And that's just a risk that's in the back of your mind, but that you're willing to take, basically.
Yeah. I mean, I think I was really freaked out after, especially old Pablo. It was one thing to have these issues happen and not pass out, but for it to happen and pass out, that's where it freaked me out. Like I was freaked out about that. Cause it's like, okay, I got lucky and it happened on a mountain bike. What if it happens on the road? That's a different story. So I'd be lying if I said like the month after I was freaked out. And I didn't ride for probably a month after old Pablo because we were going to see so many doctors in Arkansas. It was a nightmare. But it's come to the point now where I think there's probably a lot higher risks of riding a bike than worrying about this. Cars, for example. I bet you drive, like if I were to hop in my car now, I'm probably at more of a risk driving my vehicle then I would be worrying about this. So I think it's a risk, but it's such a small risk of something catastrophic happening. I can't worry about that anymore.
Yeah, and I feel like you hear that kind of from veteran doctors, and I've heard Ted said that to me too in regards to his being on blood thinners. It's just a risk assessment thing. And when you know, if you actually put pen to paper and make a hierarchy of how am I most likely to go, this issue is actually like 12th on the list.
Yeah.
So like, I'm just going to keep going.
Like we discount how we drive a car every day, which is probably the most risky thing we do every day.
Yeah.
Or riding a bike with cars. Like,
yeah.
Sadly, that's probably one of the riskiest things.
Yep. Yep. So. All right, man. Well, I need to get on the bike and I'm sure you have plenty to do also. So I'll let you go. But the last thing I was curious about is what your dad thought of the film, what his reaction was to this film.
He watched it and I went over to his house when we were back in Arizona after releasing the film. And I never even told him we were making the film. I just put it out. And if I would have never told him that it was out there. And he somehow found it and watched it. And he was super interested to hear like about the ketamine therapy and about everything that I had been through, because I hid that from him. So it was kind of relieving to sit down and talk to him about that stuff. Otherwise, if he hadn't brought it up, I kind of would have let it slide and never bring it to his attention. But like I said, our relationship's in a totally different place and I'm super thankful for.
All right, man. Well, thank you. For those that want to watch the film, it's on YouTube. Like I said, I think if you just search Shifting Mindset, Taylor Ledeen, that's Lideen, it should come up.
Thanks very much.
But thank you. I mean, I'm sure it's crazy, man. So just as a reference, like in terms of the messages we get, emails, all that sort of thing, it's probably split. It's probably a tie for the most frequent topic wise in regards to bike tech stuff. And then the mental side of things, anxiety, depression, mental health, all that sort of thing. And despite the fact that mental health feels like such a buzzword at this point, especially it feels like the pandemic really created this spike in conversation regarding it. But it still feels like we're just really on the forefront, or not the forefront, but the very early days of it being
normalized,
a topic and explored. And people, yeah, normalized, exactly. That's the term I'm looking for. Just people being comfortable discussing it. So I have no doubt that this will resonate. Both the film and our conversation will resonate with a lot of people. So thanks for having the bravery to do it.
I appreciate you reaching out, and be safe on your ride. And we'll see you at Unbound.
Sounds good.
All right,
thanks,
man.
Taylor. Hello again, everyone. Thank you so much for listening today, and a big, big thank you to Osprey for supporting today's episode. As I said at the top of the show, I had an awesome, awesome adventure ride yesterday. 8+ hours in our beautiful Southwest Colorado and New Mexico, actually. 140 miles, almost 10,000 feet of climbing, double track, single track, gravel road. It was just stellar, and it was made possible by the Duro 1.5 Osprey pack that I race with, I adventure with, and this year for 2023, all of Osprey's bike hydration packs are getting updated to 100% recycled and Blue Sign approved main body materials, which is just really indicative of the attitude that Osprey has always had, which is that they prioritize making excellent, innovative products and also just being a good company. They've always supported really awesome local organizations in my area, like Durango Trails, Durango Devo, and also certainly pay attention to the big picture issues too, like the environment. And so I want to say a huge thank you to them for doing what they do, supporting the episode. And I'm just so proud to be one of their athletes. If you'd like to go check out all of their awesome products, whether it's travel bags, book bags,
hydration packs, whatever it may be, you can go to osprey.com. I also want to say a big thank you to Lily McKelvin for editing and producing the show each and every week, even when I'm so tired from a training week that I get her this intro and outro at the absolute last minute possible when she can still get the episode out on a given week. I also want to thank all of y'all for listening. Please leave a rating, review, all that sort of thing. If that's your cup of tea, Spotify, iTunes, whatever it may be. And we will catch you next week.